Good afternoon. Welcome to Biz Talk, Believing is Seeing Talk Radio. I'm Bob Ryan.
I'm Montana Smith.
And I'm Aaron Cannata.
I'm so excited about today's show. I had two incredibly cool topics you will not believe. They're very diverse topics, but I think they're both amazing. We got a guy in studio named David Wirth. This guy, okay, you won't believe this. Everybody knows, well, most people don't, I guess, what a railgun is.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what a railgun is.
You're going to make me explain that?
Just give me a short, sweet...
It's a gun that shoots a block of metal, let's say, really, really, really fast.
Okay.
Yeah, it could be used to knock missiles out of the sky. I mean, that's how fast
these things... Oh, this is a serious thing. It's not a toy.
No, this is not a toy. This guy printed his own portable railgun, and maybe... I've been looking for an excuse to get a 3D printer. Haven't found one yet. Now I think maybe we need a BizTalk railgun.
I think
I'm a little concerned. We might not have a show in a couple of months if that's going to be your intention.
And I don't know how to segue from railguns into mental health, but...
Hopefully, if you're building a railgun, you're in good mental health.
Okay, good. Great segue.
Very good.
Great segue. Spencer Hutchins of Concert Health is going to be with us talking about a new way for patients to access mental health. And most of us that are... baby boomers grew up with the idea that mental health was kind of a taboo subject. We didn't talk about it. We weren't taught about it. And yet many of us, the baby boomers, come home, have two glasses of scotch. I mean, then we get upset at people smoking pot, but yet they're drunk. And then the Vicodin and the codeine and the Oxycontin, and it just goes on and on and on. So many people out there in America today are suffering from depression, even the other mental illnesses that need more care, like paranoia, schizophrenia, bipolar, all those things need help. They have a way that patients can access the mental health and mental care a lot easier and better than we have right now. Very excited to talk with Spencer Hutchins at Concert Health, second half of the show. But we're going to go back to railguns, and hopefully David Wirth at Fabricate Labs, or he's the founder and inventor there, now a consultant at Fabricate Labs. Hopefully David Wirth is not a participant in needing mental health because you have a railgun.
Would be a bad thing.
So I want to get into Fabricate and what you do there and the whole 3D printing and the whole technology because I'm very excited about it. But why in the world did you decide to print your own railgun? I mean, what would be the point in doing that, other than the fact that it's just so cool?
Somebody bet me I couldn't do it.
Really? So that was it.
Yep.
So that's almost as good as the fact that it's just really cool.
Yeah.
So somebody bet you could not print a railgun.
Well, it wasn't so much the printing end of it.
You couldn't produce one?
Yeah. I mean, so me and a friend were playing a game of Halo, and I was kicking his butt with the railgun. And
wait a minute. How old are you?
I was probably around 20.
Oh, okay. So, all right. Yeah. Do you still play Halo?
A little bit. Not too much these days.
It's now gotten to the point where adults can play games and not be embarrassed about it.
Yeah.
I
play video games.
Yeah. Cool. So anyhow, back to your bet.
So the guy bet me, because I was kicking his butt so many times, he knew about one of my previous little science projects, and he bet me that I couldn't build a real railgun. And so, you know, I kind of took that to heart and said, well, maybe let me see if this is even possible. So I did some research. And, you know, worked on it for about a year and a half and ended up building it. And the 3D printing really came in later.
So you built a railgun out of what? Did you have to manufacture parts for it, or were you able to get most of the parts off the shelf then?
It was about half and half.
Half and half.
I mean, a railgun's a very serious piece of hardware. It's not something you can just build.
I've seen
out
a picture of it.
You're not using PVC pipe.
Yeah, I mean, it's not something you can build off of Home Depot stuff. You know, you've got to machine the rails, and it's, you know, there's some precision machining involved.
So you put a lot into this bet.
Yeah, I guess so.
Can I ask what the project was? Can I ask what the bet was? I mean, was it $20 or $1,000 or was it a meal or?
I think it was $100.
$100. So you just out of curiosity, how much did you spend on the railgun?
More than $100.
more than $100.
So but it was fun.
You spent thousands to win a $100 bet.
Yeah, I guess you could.
That's the testosterone.
Did you know going into it you were going to be able to complete it, or was this a kind of a pipe dream? And then along the way, you realized I'm really going to do this.
I don't really start projects unless I'm fairly confident I'm going to see them through to the end. You know, if I start something, you know, I'm not going to quit on it until either I've proved it's not possible or I've done it.
And that leads us down to the road of the company that you've started. And before we talk about that, you're not just a casual inventor and observer of this stuff. You've actually been recognized by the White House, I believe, and other organizations. Mm-hmm. Good going on that, by the way, for the work that you do in the technical area. Can you talk a little bit about, other than the railgun, which I think is one of the coolest things on earth to do, can you talk a little bit about what you do in general and the technology that you work with?
Sure. That's a pretty broad question.
That gives you a lot of freedom.
Yeah. In general, I research things that I think are right on the cusp of being possible, that no one has really figured out how to put two and two together yet. And, you know, I've got a pretty deep multidisciplinary understanding of the sciences. And so sometimes I can see a piece that maybe other people are missing, and that piece allows me to make this technology come to life.
Kind of like Cuban and what he does. He's got money in different industries, and he says that one of the things that benefits him is he owns a restaurant and he owns a basketball team.
The Dallas Mavericks.
Right. And then he has different things that cross over, and that's kind of what you're talking about. You can bring information from one discipline into another that may not be there.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I definitely wouldn't compare myself to Cuban. He's on a whole different level.
Most of us wouldn't.
Yeah, he also happens to be funding one of my companies.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, he was the core funder of Fabricate Labs. So.
Really?
Well, that's interesting that I brought his name up then, because I didn't even know that. Yep. So tell us about Fabricate Labs. Mm-hmm. What do you guys do?
So Fabricate Labs is a company in San Diego, and we've developed an entirely new 3D printing process. It's called SED, stereoelectrochemical deposition, and it uses a chemical process.
Wait, back up. Stereo?
Electrochemical deposition.
Stereoelectrochemical deposition.
Mm-hmm.
I like to learn words like that so I can impress people.
Well, it's a made-up word. Half of it's made up.
It took me a long time to learn electroporation. I knew that word. Yeah. So yours is even cooler because it's longer.
Yeah. Longer.
More syllables. Yes.
But essentially what it does is you have an electroplating bath and you can literally grow metal parts out of a liquid.
So what I understand from electroplating is that the item is charged with an electrical charge and dipped into solution that has the other negative charge, or
essentially,
and it adheres to the metal.
Yes,
like a powder coating on metal kind of concept.
Right, except the powder is at the atomic scale. You know, it's atom by atom.
Okay, you just lost me. We'll come back to that. When you get down to the atomic level, my mind is not there yet. Fabricate Labs founder and inventor and now consultant David Wirth is with us. You're listening to Biz Talk, Believing is Seeing Talk Radio, and I'm Bob Ryan.
I'm Montana Smith.
And I'm Aaron Cannata.
So much more when we get back. Don't you go anywhere.
Welcome back. You're listening to Biz Talk, Believing is Seeing Talk Radio. We're broadcasting from the ESET studios today. ESET Internet Security. Do more. Want a podcast of the show? Of course you do. Go to ESPN1700.com. I'm Montana Smith.
I'm Aaron Cannata.
And I'm Bob Ryan. And don't forget, we're new, so we need your ratings. And the way you can do it, because you can't like call Nielsen and say, I listen to the show. It just won't work. But what you can do is for the next 24 hours, this show is the podcast of the show is encoded. I had no idea this technology even existed. They encode our show, and if you listen to the podcast in the next 24 hours, at least 5 minutes, I think that's what I've been told, we get a brownie point with Nielsen.
Yeah, right.
It's
we
kind
like
of
those.
A big deal.
It
we
is.
Should invite an engineer over at Nielsen on. Show them a good time,
that's
and then maybe they can just rig it up so it looks like billions of people are
watching. Oh, you're thinking about that. That's like getting the Russian bots for the likes on your Facebook page. Like?
Yeah, troll farm.
Well, yeah. Don't tell anybody, but I also do that for my personal Facebook page.
You do the like for like?
Yeah.
Oh, well, back to fabrication, and I find this fascinating. Fabricate Labs, David Wirth, founder and inventor there. He's now a consultant. David, thanks for coming in.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, you're welcome. We were talking about the technology at Fabricate Labs, and the work you do is probably more technical than most of us are even aware of, right? I mean, yeah, I'm assuming when you go to a social event, people ask you what you do. If you talk in the vernacular, they're not going to understand it, correct?
Oh, I try not to talk about that stuff at social events.
But, but when you're playing Halo with your friends, it probably comes up.
Yeah. Yeah. But the I guess the broad brush, because I asked you to describe what you do, and you said it's just really broad. But would the broad brush be that you work with materials to produce things? Would that be a simple way to say it?
Yes. I work with new fabrication techniques.
That's cool. Mm-hmm. So most of us are aware of manufacturing because we see it on How It's Made or Extreme Engineering or some of the shows, or maybe we're even in a manufacturing plant. So we kind of know what plastic looks like when it's blow molded and kind of know what machining looks like. What does it look like in your world? Are we talking about a laboratory type thing? Are we talking about 3D printers? Or are there actual manufacturing plants that take the materials you work with and produce things?
That's kind of an interesting question. I mean, obviously the fabrication process we developed is very new. You know, it's not out in the market. There are no, you know, plants that are using this yet.
So what you're doing is so advanced, it's actually not in production yet.
Right. It's in the research stage. We invented something. We're making a bigger machine. And once we have a machine that's advanced enough, we can take that to the market and start selling them.
So as I understand it, a lot of people with the 3D printers, it's something that you wouldn't see on a production line. So it's things that aren't being mass made already, right? But what sort of things would you be able to do with your technique or what you've developed that you couldn't already do with the existing 3D printers?
Right. So 3D printing right now is kind of bridging the gap between mass production and one-off prototypes.
Right.
A 3D printer can produce an intermediate range. And what that really lends itself to is mass customization versus mass production. So mass production, everybody gets the same part. Prototyping, you only make one. 3D printing, everyone can have a different part.
Mm-hmm.
And the materials that you use, are they materials that most of us would understand if you talked about them?
Absolutely.
What kinds of things are you talking about?
Mostly with our process, we work with copper and nickel.
Oh, I get that. Yeah.
Those kind of things.
They have copper pipes at Home Depot.
Absolutely.
That I get.
Yeah.
So is the production of the product you make, does the copper come in some kind of powder or liquid form so it can be printed? Obviously, it doesn't come in a solid because you'd have to manipulate it another way.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to give away too much about how the process works.
Oh, come on. This is radio.
What's the secret?
Yeah. I mean, it's an electroplating bath.
Okay.
So you use metal salts, copper sulfate.
Now that
you know,
I get.
Those kind of things.
Yeah.
Chemicals.
Okay. Have you blown anything up yet?
I blow things up just about every question. At Fabricate?
That's why he
not
does
in a while.
What he does is to blow things
well,
up.
Well, you probably like the Mythbusters then, right?
Oh, of course.
Yeah. They blow things up from time to
job.
Time. Yeah. So, are there, I heard you say a second ago, you're in the development phase of, I guess, a process. Mm. Are you creating the machinery that somebody's going to buy to manufacture their own products?
Yes. We're making the 3D printers, not the parts that come out of the 3D.
Got it. So you're manufacturing the stuff that will go into the manufacturing plant.
Yes, we're making the machines.
Okay, yeah. So you can go to Fry's or some other place, Best Buy, and buy a 3D printer for hundreds of dollars right now, right?
Yeah.
Maybe in the mid-$100. Mm-hmm. What kinds of price points are going to be on the machines you're talking about? I'm guessing it's going to be a bit higher than the consumer model that comes at home.
I can't really go too much into the price point we're looking at.
But is it over $1,000, tens of thousands of dollars?
It's going to be over $1,000,
okay,
for sure. I mean, it's a metal printer. It's got a lot more capabilities.
What I'm trying to figure out is, will I be able to afford one to put my home?
One day.
Is it going to be for individuals or are big companies or that already exist going to be buying your product to kind of augment what they're already doing?
You know, that's kind of still in flux. The technology was kind of... It can go either way. You know, there can be very big machines for very big objects, car parts, etc. It could also be applied one day to consumer products.
So they have 3D printers that can print walls for houses, right? I mean, it's
basically concrete
3D printer. Then they have them small enough to make little miniaturized parts. I'm guessing the parts you're producing are going to be the things that go into other things, or will they be more manufactured things are your parts going to build like toasters or the items that go into things like car parts?
I mean, there's a broad range of applications. You know,
so there's a bunch of things
made out of metal.
That can, Wow.
Metal, it's a non-thermal process, so it can print plastic and metal in the same part.
No kidding.
You might even be able to print semiconductors inside of the part.
Wow.
So this, you could have a device at once. You could print a phone all at once.
No kidding.
I mean, that's a long way off, yeah, but that's what this non-thermal process
enables.
Sounds
like the future is almost here.
Yeah.
There's always a software component to 3D printing, right? So you have to program something in order to build something out of this. Yep. If somebody buys these, do they have to have a specialist to understand and use this your products? Or is it going to be pretty straightforward where anybody can get started and start building, say, an iPhone from scratch?
Right. I mean, so that's always kind of the pipe dream with 3D printing. Is you buy this thing thinking it's going to be just like a hammer or a screwdriver, you can just pick it up and use it. You know, this is a fairly advanced, fairly precision machine. All 3D printers are. You know, it takes some skill to use it, just like a milling machine or a lathe.
Well, those are programmed with, what, CNC coding, I believe is what it's called, computer something, something. Mm-hmm. So is there a special coding then to follow up on that?
Mm-hmm.
Or, so somebody will have to have some education in this to use this product.
Yeah, just like anything with computers, you've got to get your files in the right format to be able to print them.
Okay, so you're in a world that is looking into the future. Most of us don't live in the world you live in. So you're thinking about things down the road a little bit because you're on the cutting edge of this technology. I'm not going to get to ask this question. I want to find out what exciting things you're thinking about that could be made other than maybe rail guns someday. We'll get to that when we get back. David Wirth is with us. He's founder, inventor, and now consultant at his old company, Fabricate Labs. You're listening to Biz Talk, Believing is Seeing Talk Radio. I'm Bob Ryan.
I'm Montana Smith.
And I'm Aaron Cannata.
So many cool things to come. Don't you go anywhere.
Welcome back. You're listening to Biz Talk, Believing It's Seeing Talk Radio. You're listening to us on ESPN 1700, but do you know you could watch us too? Watch us on Facebook, visit our Biz Talk Radio page, share your comments, ask your questions, and of course, we always appreciate your likes. Bob especially appreciates your likes, but we all do. I'm Montana Smith.
I'm Aaron Cannata.
And I'm Bob Ryan, and I do like it when you like me, please. Was that pitiful enough? Okay, or do I need to be more pitiful?
That sounded pretty sincere.
Okay, yeah. Good. At the bottom of the hour, coming up next segment, Spencer Hutchins is going to be with us. We're going to talk about mental health and your access to it. Right now, we have David Wirth with us. He is a consultant at Fabricate Labs, a company he founded, and he's an inventor. Guy that built his own railgun. I love that. How many people do you know that built a railgun?
He's the first. I've never
met anybody. It's very, very cool. David, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You're, as we were talking about before we went to break, kind of on the cutting edge of technologies in this metal fabrication world, I'm guessing. Mm-hmm. You're the first person I've talked with that's this advanced with metal fabrication, and I talk with a lot of businesses. What is fun for you to think about producing? Obviously, you built a railgun, so you've got to be thinking about other cool things that can be built with 3D printing. Maybe not even the 3D printing that your machines do, but in general, are we going to get to the point where you can fax an object via 3D, where it's scanned here and printed over there?
Oh, absolutely. We're already there.
Seriously?
You can already scan something in San Diego and print it in New York. I mean, that's already exists.
Does it have to be on the same system? Meaning, do they have to have the same exact equipment, or is it... Wow.
Yeah, you can scan something, send it through the internet. Obviously, it's limited to simple stuff like plastics, you know, and you're only going to be able to print something as a plastic. But yeah, you can already do that.
So what are some of the other things you think about when you look at the future? It probably maybe is old hat to you right now, but to most of us that don't have 3D printers, what kinds of things will we be doing down the road?
Down the road, that's kind of an interesting segue. So down the road, kind of the things that I'm looking at that are potentially disruptive industries. I think there's a lot of aerospace technologies that are very disruptive. We kind of touched on, you know, the electromagnetics. I'm also involved in some software projects currently. Cryptocurrencies is probably going to be a very disruptive industry. It's already disrupting the stock market in some ways, not necessarily affecting the stock market, but there's a kind of a second stock market that's kind of bubbling under the surface, the ICO bubble.
I want to get to the cryptocurrencies because that's fascinating to me. But real quick, I understand that on the space station and on our rockets to Mars and some of the other things we're developing, 3D printing will be an integral part of that, right? In case a part breaks, they can manufacture something on the fly, which we've never had that capability.
Yep.
Very cool.
Back the space station, yeah, they currently have a plastic 3D printer on there, and they've printed wrenches and simple tools. One of the great things that 3D printing is really good at is printing fixtures. So if you need a special bracket to mount something, you can print that up really
excellent
quick.
Excellent idea, yeah. Mm-hmm. And from what I understand, there was what's that movie, Apollo 13, where somebody saved it by having a pen to put in a ballpoint pen to stick in the a lever that broke off. Is that the right movie I'm thinking
I'm
of?
I'm not sure, but it sounds cool.
Supposedly, some mission was saved by a ballpoint pen being used in the place of a lever. Lever. I don't know which. Cryptocurrencies.
Sure.
Everybody knows about them. Everybody hears about Bitcoin.
It's the buzzword.
Yeah, blockchains and everything else. Wow. I mean, we could spend hours. We just have a couple of minutes. Mm-hmm. What do you see? You said it's going to be disruptive. Mm-hmm. It's already taking money away from investment in the stock market, right?
I wouldn't say that.
Do you think it's creating its own new market?
It is a new market. I don't know how much it's competing with the stock market. You know, I'm not, you know, I got my degree in aerospace engineering. I'm not a financial analyst.
So you're rocket science.
You could say that.
Nice.
A real rocket scientist on the show. Who knew?
I'm sure you guys interview a bunch of
I want your autograph
types.
At
we
the
probably
end of your
do,
segment.
But not many rocket scientists that are actually got degrees in rocket science. That's impressive.
Thank you.
So cryptocurrencies, is that something that's just an interest to you, or do you have a business connection to it?
So it's been an interest to me since around 2010. I've been working in that space, you know, kind of as a hobby, working with developing new types of mining equipment for Bitcoin. But since my exit from Fabricate, well, not really my exit, but since I've started to move away from Fabricate a little bit, I've been looking into crypto as potentially a new business venture.
So most people might not know, you actually have to mine a digital currency, which seems counterintuitive. Mm-hmm. How do people do that? How do digital currencies come into existence?
Sure. So kind of the 10,000 foot view is... There's a program, a computer program that everyone agrees they're all going to use. And as part of this program, there's a function called mining. And essentially what you do is you compute a math function, which is a way of, occupying your computer and tying this cryptocurrency to a limited resource, which is energy. And the more time and energy you spend mining, the more cryptocurrency you can generate. So it limits the inflation.
What's the point of I mean, obviously that you're creating a currency that you can physically use to purchase something.
Well, that's the point, is it's not physical. The point is it's decentralized.
Right. Okay. So you're creating something that you can actually purchase a physical item with.
Yes.
You could buy something online with your cryptocurrency and have it delivered to your house. Mm-hmm. How do you create that out of nothing? Who grants that to you, and why would they do it? Why does occupying your computer with a math function qualify to get you something that you can purchase online ultimately?
The same reason that, ancient civilizations tied up resources mining gold and silver. You know,
it's worth something because we all agree it is.
It's a store of value.
Holy
it's a store of value.
Cow.
Do we take for granted in this country that our dollar is pretty steady and is one of the reasons because this is not tied to any particular country, so we won't see rampant inflation, things like that won't be as much of an issue?
That was one of the founding principles of Bitcoin. Bitcoin really originated from a group of individuals, or maybe one individual called Satoshi Nakamoto. He came up with this white paper, and his motivation for developing the technology was to prevent another 2008 type financial crash where big banks, governments, et cetera, played with the currencies too much and broke the system. So Bitcoin is an attempt to get the control away from any one single entity and make it decentralized.
It fascinates me that we as a society agree that our dollar is worth what it is worth, and that can change because somebody does something different with it. Mm-hmm. But we could create anything. We could all of a sudden say a maple leaf off of a tree is now worth 2 pounds of flour, and that would be a new currency for us. But cryptocurrency exists only because we agree that it has a value.
Bitcoin, I believe, exists only because we agree it has a value. There is some utility in that you can do instant transactions, et cetera, but there are new technologies emerging on the back of Bitcoin, such as, you know, Ethereum and IOTA and these other technologies that draw on that blockchain that have more inherent value.
Okay, we're almost out of time. Do you have a quick question?
I was just going to say one of the benefits of blockchain is it can actually limit the amount that's out there.
Yes.
Just like gold and silver, there's a limited amount, and that's why it was probably worth something or a good store of value.
It's
right?
a limited resource. Yep.
David Wirth, Fabricate Labs is the company you founded. You're an inventor there, now consultant. I would love to find out what you think about in your off hours, because this is fascinating. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. This
is
great.
You're listening to Biz Talk, Believing is Seeing Talk Radio. I'm Bob Ryan.
I'm Montana Smith.
And I'm Aaron Cannata.
When we come back, we're going to talk mental health. It is really important that you stay tuned for this. I'm not kidding. Don't go anywhere.
Welcome back. You're listening to Biz Talk, Believing is Seeing Talk Radio. We'd like to take this moment to thank our engineer, Jeff Bilodeau, our music by Derek Audette, and our interns, Sarah, Andrew, Leah, Deidre, and Chrissy. I'm Montana Smith.
I'm Aaron Cannata.
And I'm Bob Ryan, and we have three of our interns in studio. I love it when they're here. It feels like an audience.
Great
Although
energy.
They're not trained yet to laugh at my jokes.
They're working on it.
They're working on it. I know. We've got to get that going because
we're crickets. Bribing them.
Is that what we're doing? We just wrapped up with David Wirth at Fabricate Labs, a guy that made his own railgun. What a cool thing is that, right? We'll give you his contact information in just a little bit in case you want to get a hold of him. I'm going to shift gears a little bit now to a more serious topic. Spencer Hutchins is with us. He is a founder of Concert Health, a company that's making access to mental health easier, better. I don't know if it's more affordable, Spencer, but you're trying to create a market where mental health is an easier function to reach for people that need it. Is that correct?
That's right. Such an important issue.
Well, thank you for being here. Tell us a little bit about Concert Health and what you folks are doing.
Yeah, sure. So we're a brand new company. Just got founded at the beginning of the year and really organized around helping all of our primary care physicians grow their capabilities inside their practice to support the whole patient, not just the physical issues, but the mental ones as well. In the United States, we have such a gap in care. You know, the best estimates are that it's only about 1 in 5 of us with a diagnosable mental health condition are actually getting diagnosed and treated. That's such a scary thought.
Is that the case because the GPs aren't trained to recognize the mental health issues, or maybe they recognize it and don't have the time? Because from what I understand, the average GP spends 7 minutes with a patient. The average patient visits 7 minutes.
Yep.
Then they have another half hour of work to do as a result of that from the documentation, the HIPAA requirements and all that. So is it that they're not trained, or maybe they recognize it but don't have the energy or the time, or maybe they don't know what to do with it?
I think all three of those are really contributed. It's a lot of factors that have come down. And there's a long time ago, we made a bad decision to separate the behavioral health system from the rest of medicine.
Isn't that interesting that we did that?
You think of it, so often it's a different building, different set of professions, and that there's a stigma. And so one of the problems is that you come in, if your knee hurts, that's the first thing you say to your doctor, right? You make a visit. Hey, my knee hurts. How can you help? If you're sad, if you're anxious, if you're abusing substances, very unlikely
that you're going to go and say, Doc, I'm drinking too much alcohol. Yep. I'm taking too much Vicodin.
And so it's acute.
Cut me off, Doc.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. You know, some will raise their hand and they really need help, but so many don't. And there's an embarrassment factor that we've got to overcome. And part of that is by saying, listen, so many of us have a primary care doctor we trust, and we need to help empower them to do more. And that's what Concert Health's doing. We're providing them both what's called a behavioral care manager, a therapist, and a psychiatric consultant, so that when they suspect a patient might be depressed, anxious, abusing substances, instead of just writing a quick script or telling them, oh, go see a therapist, they can say what's called a warm handoff, right? To say, hey, we've got someone here on my team. I want them to give you a call later today. They've got good coping mechanisms, and they want to learn more about how you're struggling, share some coping mechanisms, and really put a unified plan together. That's something that's a lot easier for a person to accept, to be ready. And it keeps that care coordinated with the rest of your conditions. Because so often we've all got lots of things wrong with us, right? And, you know, right now we treat our diabetes and our depression as if they're two separate things, but they're really not. They commingle, they exacerbate, they make it worse. And by really keeping that all under with your primary care doc, we can do a lot to make sure we have a good integrated plan. And that's what we're trying to do.
We think about healthcare today with a lot of preventative thought in it. You know, if you quit smoking, you might prevent cancer that happened down the road. You lose weight, you might prevent diabetes, et cetera. There doesn't seem to be that connection with mental health.
Yeah.
That if you help it today, it will solve some problem down the road. But what I hear you saying is that mental health and physical attributes might be very closely linked in a lot of cases.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think we're finally just beginning a process of recognizing that. And, you know, as there's a lot of talk in the United States about shifting away from this fee-for-service, get paid for every procedure, to really hold the healthcare delivery system accountable for keeping people healthy, keeping them out of the hospital, right? You know, avoiding things. And as you dig into there, you realize one of the few real big levers there is supporting people's behavioral health. If you have the same physical health conditions with a comorbidity of depression, meaning you also have depression, you're going to spend an average 2 to 3 times that year on that same condition.
What amazes me is how much attention we give to other things. Like we have so much attention paid to things that are physical. Yeah. That we have the I think Susan Coleman breast cancer awareness. We have leukemia societies, multiple sclerosis, heart, asthma, just about everything, arthritis. But I don't know if I don't even know if I could name an organization championing mental health. I can't think of one. I'm guessing they're out there, but they're not. They don't hold telethons that I'm aware of. It just doesn't have the awareness. Do you think that's because, well, first of all, am I right about that?
There's certainly some organizations. NAMI, the National Association for Mental Illness,
I've never heard of them, though.
Been around for a long time. There's quite a few, but it's always been in the shadows. You know, it's been something that's a little harder to market for, something that, you know, I think in so many conditions, you have people standing up saying, yes, I had breast cancer and I survived it. It's been less frequent for someone to say, you know, I've been dealing with depression my whole life. You know, you see it.
I'm bipolar and I'm functioning okay now.
That's right. Right?
It seems like when you do see it, it's in one of those commercials, do you or somebody you know suffer from depression? And it's ultimately like a pharmaceutical. It's
That's
like a
right.
drug saying, hey, come to us. We've got the answer.
Yep.
But shouldn't it should be a doctor, right? Or somebody, a mental health professional, who's really, if ultimately that is what you're going to do. So it seems like the system that you're putting in place is going to make it a lot more likely that somebody might get to that place where they're getting the right kind of help rather than just going to the doctor saying, I need this drug because I saw it on TV.
Yeah, that's the hope. And also the reality is people have different preferences on how they want to help treat themselves. You know, some people really like the idea of an antidepressant medication that's going to be effective for some. Others really just want talk therapy. You know, and right now, so it's so rare that you get a coordinated approach. And that's what we're trying to do too, bring it into your primary care office, that we have people that are really trained in talk therapy, helping you change your behavior, as well as, when appropriate, a psychiatrist that can really make those recommendations around appropriate medication.
Concert Health, Spencer Hutchins is with us. Spencer, there's a focus today on lowering cost in healthcare because it's not top of mind right now because of the hurricanes and other things that have come about. And we've kind of moved on in Congress past the healthcare thing. Mm-hmm. Are you looking at a cost savings by doing an intervention early with say addictions or other mental health things? Is there actual cost savings that we can document there, or is it a guess?
Huge. That's part of the reason why you're seeing health insurance companies, starting with Medicare, begin to support the services that we're doing. There's been 80 randomized control studies in the last 20 years that show when you integrate behavioral health back into primary care, that you more than pay for yourself. So you save hundreds or thousands of dollars per patient.
You're using the word behavioral health as a kind of an all-encompassing function for, or word for, mental health and substance abuse, kind of all in
exactly.
one. Right? Okay.
Yep.
You're listening to Biz Talk, Believing is Seeing Talk Radio. Spencer Hutchins is with us, founder of Concert Health. You're listening to Biz Talk. I'm Bob Ryan.
I'm Montana Smith.
And I'm Aaron Cannata.
Don't you go anywhere. This is really important. Stay with us.
Welcome back. You're listening to Biz Talk, Believing is Seeing Talk Radio. And we're broadcasting today from the ESET Studios. ESET Internet Security, do more. Get a podcast of today's show and any of our previous shows. Now we're talking. Go to ESPN1700.com. I'm Montana Smith.
I'm Aaron Cannata.
And I'm Bob Ryan. Earlier in the show, we had David Wirth with us, founder and inventor. And if you want to get a hold of him, I didn't give out his email, but it's dwirth9, the numeral 9, dwirth9 at gmail.com. If you need to get a hold of him for something. Right now, we're talking to Spencer Hutchins. He's founder of a company called Concert Health. Spencer, thanks for coming in today.
My pleasure.
Important topic. It's something that we just don't have enough information on in our world today. We talk about so many of the other important things in healthcare, such as cancer and heart disease, et cetera. We just don't have that same conversation about mental health. And I want to talk a little bit about the cost and how it's justified in there. But real quick, what got you into this business? I mean, you're a young guy. It just seems like it's almost like you have a passion for it beyond just the normal business venture.
Yeah, I'd say really two things that drove it. I've been at the intersection of healthcare and technology for a long time, helping to build software companies, and really got increasingly convinced that, you know what, if we're going to transform healthcare and make it better, more affordable, more effective, and more accessible for everyone in this country, it's not just going to be writing code and building apps. It has to be really rebuilding the whole system. And that's where I had the good fortune of meeting two of my co-founders who are real national experts in psychiatry, psychology, and have been at the forefront of this model. And they knew a lot about the clinical side, how to really do this work, how to change people's lives. I knew a little bit about how to start up hustle, right? And we said, hey, let's get together and do it. And like everybody, I've got close friends, close family that have really struggled with behavioral health. And you've seen both sides of it, how much it can transform someone's life if they get the support they need, and just how easy it is in the United States and really everywhere in the world to fall between the cracks and just watch how much that impacts your life by not getting any support.
And we've had so many changes, especially here in San Diego County, with mental health. First of all, we shut down, I guess statewide, we shut down most of the mental health institutions in the 80s and dumped everybody out on the street.
Yep.
So now this big group we call homeless used to be in some kind of institution or some, they got the help at some point in time. Now it's not happening. And I've looked at some numbers that are astounding at how many people have some kind of depression. The numbers, I mean, I'm sure you know them more better than I do. And the other thing that we don't talk about much is the opiate addiction crisis in the United States. We're hearing it on the news because of the overdoses, but that's a lot of times from the street drugs, the street opiates. But we have a huge crisis, as you know, with the prescriptions that are written for opiates.
Yep. It has been a huge issue. And because our business is starting with this Medicare program, you know, frankly, when we started it 8 or 9 months ago, I thought it wouldn't, you know, raging in the news, I didn't think it would happen too much with our early partners, our early practices, thinking, oh, that's happening to younger people, right? You know, we're talking about grandma and grandpa. And we've been amazed at just how much these physicians have said, we have so much drug-seeking behavior, you know, whether or not we were the ones that wrote the original script or somewhere else, it was a hospital, it was a surgery, you know, wherever it started, and really need to find a way to support people.
The whole pain treatment industry right now is overwhelmed with people seeking narcotics of some sort because we have become a nation of addicts.
Yep.
I heard that 10% of our society is taking some kind of opiate on a regular basis.
Yeah, it's just
That's
amazing.
A lot. One out of 10 people on the road's high on Vicodin.
Yep.
That's scary when you think about it, right? So we haven't gotten into your business model yet.
Yep.
So, and you just started this less than a year ago, which amazes me that you've actually gotten this far. Some recognition with Medicare and possibly so. So how does the business model work at Concert Health?
Sure. So the exciting thing that's happened is there's been this evidence building about this model, how effective it is, but it's never been something that most doctors could access. So they say, yeah, I wish I could supply more support for my patients, but I can't get paid for it. Medicare just created some new billing codes that says, hey, if you're now going to do this, we believe in the research, we believe it's the right thing to do for patients, and we believe it's going to save money for us in the long run because you're going to avoid so many other complications, that we'll pay, it ends up being about $125 per patient per month. If you've got a social worker calling them, if you've got a, you're giving them evidence-based screening tools, therapy, you have a psychiatrist that's reviewing their information, making medication recommendations. Really, really exciting. And in theory, all 40 million Americans on Medicare got access to this program in January. Very, very few are doing it. no one's heard about the program, right?
Are you talking about the access to the program at concert?
No, access to the program at Medicare. Medicare is saying any doctor, anybody on Medicare, if they want to build this, Medicare will pay.
But do the doctors have somebody to refer people to, is that where concert health comes
exactly.
in?
Yeah, exactly. That's the problem. Most of the doctors haven't even found out. If you're paying attention to policy right now, you're wondering what happened with Trump Care. You know, you're not looking at individual changes at Medicare. After that, even if they found out about it, they'd have to learn about it clinically. They'd have to hire therapists. They'd have to find a psychiatrist. There's a lot about it.
Oh, so even we're if doing they know is, the system exists,
it's complicated.
They'd have
it's
to
risky.
Build it out.
Yeah, it's risky. And so we're creating another path, which is, hey, we've got the team. We built the technology that lets them work from home. So we're finding some of the best social workers in the country, giving them the flexibility to work around their schedule, work from home, and provide support for those primary care groups.
So it doesn't matter where they are in the nation. If they're working from home, they can provide the support.
Yeah, that's right. In medicine, it's never quite that easy. So you need to have state licenses. And so we're live right now in California and Arizona. And so we have to staff by state. You know, as we grow, we'll probably start to get our team members licensed in multiple states.
So you have this model built that's in Arizona and California right now.
Yeah.
Even if it's built and accessible, there's all these physicians that you have to let know it exists, and they have to know how to access it without taking a lot of time per patient.
Yep.
I'm guessing that's kind of what your big challenge is right now, is educating the physicians, or are you educating the consumer that are going to tell their physicians?
It's really both. And our focus is really on, our marketing focus is often on those physicians. I've been a non-doctor, non-clinician in medicine for a long time. Normally, doctors are a pretty confident bunch. You don't sell things to them by telling them they're not doing something right. But I've been amazed in behavioral health. They've been the first ones to say, listen, we are not able to support the patients like they need to be. I don't know. I'm not an expert in these drugs. We have no support on talk therapy, which is what a lot of people want. We need a better system. And so they get really excited to find out that there's new payment in place and there's an opportunity for them to help improve care for their patients, to expand the capabilities of their practice.
Pay for the time they put into
That's
it.
Right.
Was this Medicare decision pivotal to you starting the company? Was it this shotgun thing, or you already had the idea? You're shaking your head yes.
Yeah. Well, I started learning about the evidence of this model last summer or so, and was saying, my God, and was reading the research that just showed amazing results. After one of the pivotal studies, this whole model called the IMPACT trial was here in San Diego almost 20 years ago. This is how long it takes for medicine to do anything. 1,800 patients, 900 get normal care, 900 get this new collaborative care model. In the normal care, 19% had meaningful reductions in depression symptoms. The collaborative care, 50%. So it's two
Seriously?
And a half times
oh.
better.
Meaningful.
So we were saying, oh my God, what's the way to get this into the market? How do we spread it better? Then we found out, oh, Medicare is actually moving forward. And that's when it clicked to say, hey, we got the clinical model. Now we have a way to really make it work.
Spencer, let me ask you to hold that. We'll talk more about that when we get back. Spencer Hutchins is with it. Concert Health is his company. You're listening to Biz Talk. I'm Bob Ryan.
I'm Montana Smith.
And I'm Aaron Cannata.
Stay with us. We will be right back.
Welcome back to Believing the Seeing Talk Radio, Biz Talk. Our Monday guest will be Gary Peterson, CEO of Gap Intelligence. We're very interested to hear what he has to say. I am Montana Smith.
I'm Aaron Cannata.
And I'm Bob Ryan. Glad you're with us. Spencer Hutchins is with us, Concert Health. Spencer, if somebody wants to get a hold of you, how would they be able to do it?
Website's a great spot. So
okay.
It's concerthealth.io.
Concerthealth.io. What's the .io?
It means input, output.
Seriously?
Yeah.
It's sort
of a techie computer. What really is happening is someone was squatting on .com and they wanted $5,000 for me to buy it, and we were bootstrapping the company, and so...
You went with .io?
Yeah, we
you
went with that. But there's a better way to use that $5,000. So.
You just started this a few short months ago. I mean, it seems like you've made some amazing progress. The model is to support the medical community, primarily general practitioners at this point.
That's right.
And give them a way to help patients that might have some mental health or substance abuse
yep.
issues, right? And it's more seamless for them, and they now have codes to get paid for the service. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we think it's three really valuable, the value proposition is threefold inside of these practices. You know, better care for an important and difficult part of their population. Most of the times they know they're not supporting great now. New revenue into their practice is important. It's so hard, especially for the independent practitioners, to stay independent, to not get gobbled up. This is an opportunity to drive some revenue into their practice, make it sustainable. And then finally, all the GPs are getting pushed into or either jumping into or being pushed into some type of what we call value-based models in which they're held accountable, not just for the number of times they see the patient, but is the patient healthy? Are they staying out of the hospital? And for them to compete, especially for the smaller groups to be able to compete with the big behemoths, they need these type of services. And so that's what one place that we think we can add a lot of value is putting them in a much better position to succeed in those kind of models.
Our political system has been all over healthcare for a decade now. Everything seems to be a hot potato in there. Yep. Where does mental health fit in that? Is it politicized at this point?
Fortunately, it doesn't seem to be. You know, there's a huge fight about the insurance exchanges of Obamacare and, you know, what we move and, you know, what we're doing with it. But it feels like mental health has been able to build more of a bipartisan consensus. I mean, the reality is that we all have family, we all have friends, we all have ourselves. It's not a partisan issue, recognizing that people need that support. And the research is overwhelming that when we really get a handle on it, it improves people's lives and it reduces how much money they spend in the healthcare system, which we all want.
Do you have any idea how many Americans are afflicted with some kind of diagnosable mental health
issue?
Yeah,
so the best research is it's between 20 and 25% every year.
Seriously?
They have that. And you know,
that's a lot of people.
It's an enormous amount. And one thing, some people are going to have it their whole life. It's something that is genetic, chemical, right? They're going to have. Others, it's really around points in their life. You know, for the population we deal with in Medicare, you see it a lot when a spouse dies.
It's event-driven.
You see it a lot around if you're losing the ability to drive, right? Moving into a facility away from your home. Things like that can have such an impact on your life. It doesn't mean you're a different type of person. Doesn't mean you're flawed. It means there's something happening in your body in the same way you get sick and the same way you...
You get a cold, that doesn't mean you're a flawed human being. Yeah. You have a cold.
Yeah, we're not trained to go to our doctor and say, hey, I'm feeling extra sad today, right? Like, it's tough for me to get out of bed these days.
Yeah.
Maybe only a handful or a small percentage are going to or have the means to see some sort of psychiatrist. I'm curious, do you guys, are you creating a novel system to like connect people to existing mental health professionals, or are you actually hiring the mental health professionals themselves that you're then putting them in touch with? Are they part of your staff?
Yeah, we're gonna mostly be hiring, particularly on the care management side, the therapist side. The psychiatrists will more be part-time contractors, but a big piece of this in the long run is you need to have a really cohesive team. You know, sometimes people in healthcare, they get excited about the Uber for, you know, X and saying, oh, we'll just go out and find a network that's more scalable. But it's not just about having an access to a person, right, a therapist. It's making sure they're a great one, making sure that it's trained. They really know how to work with the PCP. They know how to work with the psychiatrist, and they function as a team. And to do that, it can't be just something they do. It has to be something they're trained in other. So we're really going to, you know, focus on that. And it means we'll have to build a big team if we build a big company, but that's how we think it's the right way to help people. So we're going to
do that. So you're looking at psychiatrist and psychologist, and I'm guessing marriage and family counselors.
Yep. LCSW, social workers, even some nurses.
That would be great. So if somebody goes into their physician and maybe the conversation starts off with, I'm really tired these days.
Yep.
I've been sleeping a lot, and the doctor asks the right questions, finds out that maybe this is depression.
Yep.
What's the process then? What do they do from there under Concert Health system?
Well, so what we do is the practices that we've we're partnered with, they'll just have a flyer there that explains our services and has the face of a few of our care managers that support that practice. And so they can say, listen, like you said earlier in the show, we've only got 7 minutes together. This is going to take longer than that. What I want to do is introduce you to Leslie. She's on my team. She's actually going to be able to talk to you from home. She's going to give you a call later today or tomorrow and check in with you every couple of weeks, see how you're doing, share some coping mechanisms, and keep me totally in the loop. That's what we call a warm handoff. That way the doctor can move on with their day. They've got a rapid pace. They've got to see their patients. But there's someone that's going to follow up with the patient right away that can help support them, help dig in, maybe help confirm the diagnosis, start treatment, really make sure that no one's slipping through the cracks.
So the person that calls them actually has some authority to move the treatment forward. If it's not just a simple matter that they can talk about and give some basic guidance on,
that's right.
Maybe they determine the person needs some more treatment. Can they actually get them to a psychiatrist or a psychologist?
Well, that person that reaches out is a care manager with a clinical. So that person that's going to reach out is a social worker, an MFT. They're going to be doing a couple of things. First is checking the symptom severity, asking you a set of questions to see, okay, how's your depression now versus how it was a few weeks ago? And then it's to do some talk therapy with them right there. Things like behavioral activation. You know, what is it? When you get sad, what makes you feel better? Oh, exercise. What can you do today? What can you do tomorrow? Let me call you in a couple of days, or let me call you tomorrow. Let's see if you go for that walk this afternoon to your favorite coffee shop, right? Did you call your grandchild? You know, what is it that gets you out of this funk, and how do we help you do there? Some of it's to be there. So a piece of it's that, and a piece of it's to they're off, the person talking to you is not a doctor, but they can also be saying, you know, are you taking that med that you were just prescribed? Oh, if not, why not? Oh, is the side effect? Well, let me tell the doctor, let me talk to them and see if we can change that up.
Is this things these professionals naturally do and know because of their training, or is this a script that you guys have set up at Concert Health?
Yeah,
like, go through these checklists.
Right.
Yeah.
Can they determine if, say, there's an addiction issue?
Mm-hmm.
Is that part of the intake process?
Yeah, very much. I mean, these are really talented, amazing clinicians, and so calling it a script would be underselling the skills that they have. They have master's degrees and have a lot of training. Part of it is we act like a primary care version of that, so we stay away from hour-long phone calls where you get into deep trauma about your childhood. It's more about what can we do in 20, 30 minutes to really activate you, change your behavior, and get you moving. And then they're there to say, okay, you know what, after a few months, is this working, or do you need a higher level of care? Do you need a therapist that's going to be seeing you more often, more frequently? Do you need a psychiatrist? And many people we can help, many we can move on, or some will then have to move on to higher levels of care.
And the higher levels of care might be like addiction treatment or a psychiatrist.
That's right.
That something that you manage at Concert, or does it go beyond the management that you're talking about?
Yeah, so when it gets to a higher level of care, that would be something that we would advise their GP to say, listen, we've been in for 4 months, a little bit better, but feels like we're stalling. I think they're going to need more. Why don't we go ahead and find a referral in the community that you can do? But the nice thing is, let's say they have to go see a psychiatrist. Let's say they have to go to a rehab center or something like that for addiction. Right now, when they leave that rehab center, they go to nothing, right? But in a practice that has embraced collaborative care, they can pass them back off to us so that patient can get picked back up by a care manager, have a psychiatrist that's reviewing the charts to help make sure people stay on path. So it prevents those cliffs you so often see in medicine. Like, hey, once you leave that psychiatric hospital, an example, or a rehab hospital after addiction, it's like you're on your own. You know, hopefully now the practices that we work with will have the capacity and the capability to say, no, you're not on your own. We really have someone that has the time to check in with you every week, every couple of weeks.
Spencer Hutchins, Concert Health, concerthealth.io is the website. Mental health is something we need to talk more about in the United States, and I'm glad somebody like you is doing this, Spencer. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Great show. I love walking away from this show with this level of intellectual stimulation and understanding. You've been listening to Biz Talk, Believing is Seeing Talk Radio. I'm Bob Ryan.
I'm Montana Smith.
And I'm Aaron Cannata.
You folks have a great and prosperous day.
Bye.